Okay, I think we're ready to start to get this show on the road. It's good if we could start a little bit early because we have a lot of things to cover and a lot of speakers, so it's time to start. Welcome to this seminar that will be about the administration of DNSSEC. And we have a lineup of speakers. You can see them over here. We'll start out with Steve Crocker that will give you a background of the DNSSEC area and a little bit of history. Then we'll have Jake Palm and Johan Irén giving you the customer perspective of DNSSEC. And then we have a couple of manufacturers or people that represent DNSSEC management solutions, maybe rather. Okay. So I have a few practical things that I would like to mention. This seminar is being recorded. So if you have questions to ask, you have to wait for the hostess of the room, and she will bring over a microphone. And, yeah, that's about it. So let's welcome to the stage Dr. Steve Crocker. And maybe we could give him a little hand.
Thanks, Morgan. Am I alive? Sounds like I am. Well, thank you very much. Pleasure to be here. I always feel a little bit humble coming to Stockholm because this is the absolute center of advanced activity in DNSSEC. And I think it is legitimately the case that there is more known here, both about theory and practice, than anywhere else in the world. So with that, I'll say a few words and then try to get out of the way, and maybe there will be some questions later. Let's see, first thing. Okay, so in various degrees, I'll talk about these topics, a little bit of history, a little bit of current status, some of the current and anticipated difficulties, and a word or two about where we're going. I suspect most of the people and most of you have a pretty good understanding about both DNS and about DNS security, so I'll hold it to just a couple of slides. Here's a picture of the data flow with most of the emphasis on the provisioning side, that is, putting the information into the system. The zone administrator on the left, master file, caching forwarders that may exist out in the world. And then on the far right, a resolver, which is acting on behalf of a user who's making a query. The main point of this slide is to show where things can go wrong, which are very many places. The arrows in black are where there's an opportunity for people who have access to the innards, who have privileged access to the system, so-called insider threat, can cause bad things to happen. The ones in red are in many ways more more alarming. Those are the places where an external bad guy, a hacker of some sort, can cause the wrong data to be sent back to the user, either by intercepting and replacing the information on the wire or in the air, or by supplanting information that's in caches, cache poisoning or pollution of one sort or another. It's these kinds of problems, particularly the ones with the red arrows, that we seek to put a stop to by putting a cryptographic authentication, a signature, added to the process so that the end user or the end user system is able to tell whether the data that he's receiving is, in fact, the same data that was created at the origins of this process. How bad is the threat? Well, in a wireless environment, it's relatively easy to substitute DNS responses. For a while, I carried a demonstration on my laptop, and in a room like this, we would carefully and with advance notice turn it on and then show people that we could redirect their queries without much trouble. You can redirect to a false site, steal passwords, copy all the information going back and forth. Excuse me. And now, in the past few months, we've seen rise of the cash poisoning kinds of attacks that stimulated this work quite a long time ago in the early 90s through the work of Dan Kaminsky, who showed that it's possible to defeat the partial protection that is provided by a randomization of courts and without the randomization ports, the sequence numbers. But even with randomization ports added and other things that increase the entropy, quite a few circumstances exist where it's possible to overwhelm those defenses with a large number of attacking packets, if you will, and defeat those protections so that even though an enormous amount of energy has been put into trying to protect DNS with new patches to software, the improvement is not satisfactory. It's not sufficient to hold the problem for a long time. And DNSSEC is basically required. So DNSSEC, as I'm sure we know, secures the mapping of the name to addresses or other records in the DNS. It's not a complete solution to security on the Internet. There's lots of other things that have to be protected, the routing system and addressing system, for example. One slide summary of what DNSSEC is, data authenticity and integrity by signing the resource records. It's a public key-based system, so there is a public-private key pair at every level. The private key is held privately, of course, by the zone owner. And the public keys are authenticated by a signature at the parent level. So this is a hierarchical system, much like an ordinary public key infrastructure, except that the hierarchy is the DNS hierarchy instead of a separately established hierarchy. Concern that triggered the design of this was raised in early 1990s with demonstrations of cache poisoning. It was actually brought up at a fairly high levels in the U.S. government, which caused the initiation of DNSSEC design work. I got a call one day. I was vice president of Trusted Information Systems, which was doing a lot of government research work. Vince Cerf called me up, and he said, we've got a problem. He had been alerted about this. And we started immediately designing the addition to the DNS protocol. It's somewhat embarrassing that it's taken maybe a decade and a half, depending upon how you count, to go from that raising of the alarm to having a design that was fully specified. The main reason for the lengthy delay is that it took three major design cycles instead of only one. I put the word final in quotes here that was standardized in March 3.5 years ago, my goodness, with RFCs 4033, 34, and 35, because even though we thought we were done there, some additional things emerged. Zone walking is a side effect of the design, and that violated some emergent privacy requirements, which led to the creation of a small change to the spec with the addition of the NSEC 3 definition. And that was standardized in March of this year. And there are some other parts to the system, key rollover in particular. And the preferred scheme is documented in RFC 5011 a year ago. So that's the design process. And it would be nice if things happen naturally from design to total deployment, but that's not the case. In some cases, deployment is easy in the case of security protocols, and in particular, a security protocol that requires two working parts. It requires signatures in the zones, and it requires that the software that checks, that retrieves responses also check the signatures. And so you have a chicken and egg problem in which both sides have to evolve. So that makes the deployment process much more lengthy. Software products and tools have to evolve. There's documentation, a lot of awareness, consciousness raising, Some services have to develop, and then we need early adopters that lead the way. And those early adopters have to be on both sides of the process, on zone signers and on validators. It has worked out that it's better to get the zone signers going first and then the validators come along behind them instead of the other way around. And then I commented here that there's a bunch of loose ends. What do you do about holes in the tree? What do you do about the root? And various other details, if you will. Some good news, as I said at the beginning, when I come to Sweden, I know that I'm at the center of the universe with respect to DNSSEC. It's been heartwarming to watch the leadership here from .se, from the technical community here, and with the cooperation of the ISPs, the registrars, and the banking community, all putting forth a coordinated effort. I was privileged to be here in February last year at a formal launch of the commercial DNSSEC after it had been in trial for a while. Been watching my friend Kerry Karp move .museum through the same process, a much smaller kind of specialty operation, but it's very nice to see that it's moved. Bulgaria, Puerto Rico, Brazil, Czech Republic all signed. Coming soon, .org, India, United Kingdom, Mexico, the U.S. government, and I apologize to Sarah that I forgot to put Portugal on this list. How soon is it coming? Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Beginning of 2009. I will fix the slide next time that I. Yeah. Okay. And hopefully, the root and COM and net will be coming along. We don't have formal announcements as to timing, but there are some positive indications, which I will mention a bit later. Here's a memorandum from the. It says at the top, Executive Office of the President. The line underneath is the relevant line, Office of Management and Budget. In the United States, this is the agency within the U.S. government that sits above all of the ministries and coordinates is a polite term for controls the budgets of the rest of the government, and through that power can issue regulations saying you will do the following because the consequences can sometimes be quite negative. I don't know if I can highlight this. The federal government will deploy DNSSEC to the top-level .gov domain by January 2009. In government terms, that's like right now. That's immediate. We'll see whether it actually happens, but it is, and this document is dated August 22nd, 2 months ago. 2 months ago. The rest of this, I only grabbed pieces of it, but it says that below the .gov top-level domain, the rest of that domain will be filled in and signed throughout by the end of 2009. So leadership from the top level and then the subordinate zones. As a sort of accident of history in the way that the Internet developed, the U.S. has two top-level domains just for use within the U.S. government. One is .gov, and then on the defense side, it has .mil. So one can watch both of those over a period of time. And then there's also a .us domain, and then there's the root. All of those are sort of four separate government-managed or coordinated activities. They also have a role in .us, as I said, and in .edu, as it turns out. On the validation side, a very important part of the equation is getting recursive resolvers, which are DNSSEC aware, issuing queries for signed responses. As part of the initiative here, Telia has had in place recursive resolvers for a good while. Comcast in the United States has just started with a resolver that's available to customers to use if they want. University of California, Berkeley has put one on its campus, working a bit with the government of India, and it's in the process of putting one together as an experimental testbed for its ISPs to use. Supporting all of this has to be software. There's actually much more software development here than I have listed, and I will made myself a mental note to flesh this out. But the leaders have included Internet Systems Consortium, which that's IFC, that brings out the Bind software, NLL Labs with NSD, and Unbound. Sparta has a series of supporting tools and several others, and I've listed some references at the end of this. So that's the good news. Problems area as well. End system compatibility, that's small, that's routers and firewalls in the homes and offices. The Trust Anchor repository for distributing the secure entry points for zones that don't have signed parents. And a piece of that general puzzle is the signing of the root and distributing of the root signature. Support for registrars, improvements in software so that a lot of the rough edges are smoothed out. For example, there are a lot of knobs to set, a lot of parameters to set about things like what the lifetime of keys should be and how often things should be refreshed and so forth, which are, in my judgment, best worked out in a coordinated fashion and handed over to the people who have to run these things rather than sort of left as an open problem to be solved by each and every separate manager. A different area that I think will pose some issues is the coexistence of IPv4 and IPv6 networks and the translation mechanisms that are beginning to appear that bridge across these that are going to create at least the appearance of a problem of because some of the strategies involve DNS rewriting effectively so that if I'm sitting on an IPv4-only network and I need to reach a service that's available on an IPv6-only network and there is some device in the middle that can bridge all of that, when I ask for the address of that service, I may be asking a DNS resolver that is cognizant of the fact that it has to bridge this. And so it will make the lookup and discover that there's no IPv4 address for my service, but there is an IPv6 address. And so it may say very helpfully, well, I will create an IPv4 address inside the local network here, and then I will intercept the or accept the connection, and then I will rewrite the packets and send them out over IPv6. In that process, it has to also impersonate, if you will, the service that it is trying to respond to, and that would defeat the straightforward use of DNSSEC. That is the statement of the problem that gets posed in that scenario. I think the solution, which I don't want to spend a lot of time on, is to step back a bit and say, well, we really have a more complicated trust environment here because we've created, in effect, an overlay network. And that's the beginning of a long discussion, but I wanted to just simply flag that as one of the areas that's going to emerge. One of the definitions of being a pioneer taken from the imagery of the Old West is that you can tell a pioneer by the guy who's got the arrows in his back. So here a problem was uncovered with the devices that live in the customer premises that either could not accept packets beyond a certain size or could or couldn't handle some of the flags associated with DNSSEC. One side effect was that the small town of Gavila disappeared briefly from the net, sort of got cloaked. Urgent study of the problem, very nice work done here by Patrick Wallstrom. And then in the last several months, both Nominet and Core Competence under our sponsorship and with a lot of support from others conducted a study that expanded on the work here and was nicely coordinated with it. The purpose of this is to show you sort of the shape of what that data looks like. We tested 24 routers and firewalls in a variety of circumstances, and you can see that from the coloring that the results are not perfectly good. They're not perfectly bad, but they're not perfectly good. Out of the 24 devices tested, Some operate only in a mode that passes DNS queries through. Others, that's what we call route mode. Some operate it in proxy mode where they act as their own DNS resolver and go out and accumulate the responses. Some will switch back and forth between those two modes. Some can be configured. Others cannot be configured to change. And by configured, I mean that when they are handing out the address to a DHCP response, whether or not they name themselves as the DNS resolver or whether they're willing to name something else. Here's a summary of the results. Green is good, and the other colors are not so good. Out of the 24, 6 would work without any difficulty at all. Unpack the box, plug them in, and the results are fine. 9 more could be configured so that there would be no problem seen by the client. And of the remaining 9, 7 of the remaining 9 could be used in a mode where the client overrides the DHCP response and sends the packet through it to upstream. And 2 had problems that were not easily maneuvered around at all. So depending upon how you interpret these results, they're either a little bad or a lot bad. If you're an ISP thinking about the cost of customer service calls, this is not so good at all, and says that you really want an improvement in these devices, or you want to tell users what devices they should use and what devices they should stay away from. We're expecting and hoping that statistics like this change substantially over a period of time. By communicating these statistics back to the vendors and making all of the data available, and at the same time working with ISPs so that they include this in their testing and in their qualifications. Trust Anchor repository, different area, need to distribute keys of signed zones that have unsigned parents. There's been a lot of controversy about this, partly because it's an additional instruction, requires more work, or because it's not standardized, or because it's an additional trust model, or that there's a fear that whatever's put into this area might persist longer than desired and hang around too long. My view, and this is unabashedly a personal and strongly held opinion, is that this is a necessary addition to the structure and that it would completely solve the problem of how you get things going in the beginning. I'm much less worried about the trust issues, much less worried about it hanging around too long. And I'll just leave that hanging there. Registrars are a very important part of the equation and have not had a whole lot of attention, although that's beginning to change. We need to get at least a few registrars in every area that are able to support DNSSEC. It's not essential to get all of them working because if a registrant is intent upon being able to register a signed zone, that could be one of the things that determines which registrar to choose. We're working with a very small registrar called Names Beyond to bring them up to speed and get them going, and that's going along very nicely. The first target is .org, but they'll certainly work with others. But that's just intended to provide a kind of a threat, if you will, so that other registrars see that they don't have to be first and they only have to choose whether they want to be last. I mentioned IPv6, IPv4 translation, and as I indicated, I think that this is fundamentally a paradigm shift as an overlay network, and then one has to work through what those trust issues are and to burden DNSSEC as having to work seamlessly across that, I think, is overburdening DNSSEC. And as I say, I sort of raise that as an issue and not try to solve it completely here. With respect to signing the root, there are a couple of different things in progress. ICANN's IANA function is building an interim trust repository to publish the keys for top-level domains who have them. That's a web-based publication until the getting the keys into the root is worked out. The U.S. Department of Commerce, NTIA, has a notice of inquiry in progress right now, asking various questions. And it looks as if this will result in some period of time, hard to tell exactly when, in a decision to get the route signed. There are two competing proposals visibly on the table. I have no idea if there are others that are sitting around in the background. One from ICANN and one from VeriSign, and I've given pointers to their published proposals here, which are interesting, worth reading. And, in fact, I commend you all to read the notice of inquiry and see what that process is going to look like. I've estimated that the route will be signed sometime in the next 1.5 to 2 years. I'm not giving out very long odds on this, so don't come to me and complain too badly if it takes longer. But I'll buy beer if it's done more quickly. I will. I think a number of major CCTLDs and GTLDs will be signed over the next year. And very important, I think there will be announcements relatively shortly by major software vendors about DNSSEC support in products that are very widely used. And that, I think, will make a big difference. Deployment in registrars is important, as I said, and incorporation in the end systems. So summary is I think it's essential to include DNSSEC. Any of you who are responsible for zones, enterprise level or top level or whatever, get your zone signed, insist that your parent zone be signed. Sitting here in Sweden, this is not an issue. Sweden is already. And on the other side of it, begin checking signatures. Here's these slides are available. They're on the net, and there's a set of pointers here to various resources. So thank you very much.
We could take a few questions if you have questions for Steve. Don't be shy.
I've answered all questions. I'm glad.
Okay, so let's wrap things up then. Okay. All the questions are answered. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Could you wrap us up?
Hello, my name is Fredrik Palm. I work at Handelsbanken. For those of you who don't know Handelsbanken, who is not from Sweden, we're one of the big fours here in Sweden. I will start to talk about why we decided to develop our own DNSSEC key management tool, and Johan will then explain what the tool is about, what the complexities behind it were. DNSSEC at Handelsbanken, the status about 2 years ago was probably like everyone else around the world. We're going to do it. Yeah, sure. I've seen the PowerPoints. I read the documents. I know the standards are so-so, hopefully good. Let them mature. But, I mean, that's not much difference from anyone else, really. And along came a meeting between the big four banks here in Sweden and .sc. This was the meeting that Kjell Riedner explained to you who were here yesterday about. The same group, same people. There were people from the business side. There were people like me, architects, techies. Everyone was there trying to discuss, okay, what to do about DNSSEC. We share a common interest, the four Swedish banks. We need to secure as far as possible internet banking, as well as email. And at that time, during the first meetings, my view of DNSSEC was very naive. I thought, okay, no problem, let's do it, get a couple of keys, sign the zone, but that wasn't entirely true. As we started to discuss with people within this group and also within a separate technical track, so to speak, that we've forked off of these discussions with .se and the technical guys, I and the colleagues at Handelsbanken started thinking about the requirements for the tool. and these are the requirements that we came up with. GUI as well as CLI. Well, nothing in the GUI that we want to have can be only in the GUI. It must also be in the CLI, which means that anything that we want to do can be scriptable and automated. Split design, that is there to enable us to, if we want to perform the KSK-related tasks offline and then transport the result from that using a USB key or whatever. And the lucid presentation is, if you're using the graphical part, it must be easy to see what state all the keys are in for one or more domains. Because this is, as you will hear from Johan, the major part, keeping track of the state of the keys. And at that time, which was around a year ago, the tools we found couldn't do any of this, or could only do parts of this. None of them could do all of it. So, during these discussions with .se and Johan and within the banking group, the complexities, I mean, they just kept on growing, which meant that for those of you who know Handelsbanken, the first bullet up there, don't rush things. It's very Handelsbanken. And it was really good in this case, as it turned out. There are complexities, but we're not afraid of them. We want to, you know, meet them head on. And also, we have to keep tabs on what the world is doing. And this is very important, especially like Dr. Crocker told you about the .org and everything that's happening now. Oh, sorry, .gov that's happening. Going to production. These are nothing secretive, nothing strange, but this is the way we're going to do it. One thing that's not up here that I haven't put up here that I forgot was we had to do a risk analysis. And this is especially due to the thing that happened in Gävle with the town. Well, the entire town didn't disappear, but for a couple of users, they couldn't access the town's homepage. Yeah, that was it. Johan, tell you about what the tool is about.
Thank you. So I will not tell you all about the tool because it's not complete yet, but I will focus on some of the underlying complexity in developing this type of stuff. And I'm sure we will have here similar things from several of the other presenters, because what we are doing here is to develop a DNS, a key management system, and that seems to be sort of the in thing to do these days. Everyone, including my mother, is actually doing this. But just to set the topic a bit, what is actually a key rollover? Well, a key rollover is obviously the replacement of one crypto key by another. And this is not a DNS particular problem in any way. It's something that ought to be a part of any crypto system. It isn't, but it ought to. In the DNS case, it's possibly slightly more complicated and challenging because we have vast numbers of keys, and we also have these keys distributed in all sorts of interesting fashions, and in some cases we have keys that we want to replace rather frequently. So the whole volume of the thing makes this a daunting problem rather than key rollovers by itself being something new. On the other hand, that's sort of what DNS does. Anyways, I mean, DNS always sort of run into scaling issues. Then, of course, we have the other version of rollover, which is the not so very ordered replacement, and that's called an emergency queue rollover. So if we look at the so-called zone signing key to begin with, this is basically what it's about. We have an old zone signing key, and we use this old zone signing key to generate signatures. All is fine. At some point in time, we want to replace the old zone signing key with a new zone signing key. And at some point in time, we want to begin to generate signatures with the new key and also stop creating signatures by the old key. Then, of course, because of how stuff works in distributed systems, and we have delays and propagation issues in the infrastructure, we will also have old signatures that sit around in caches and things, and they will expire over time, and we need to track that time. And we actually need to make sure that this new zone signing key is available to everyone once they need it to verify these signatures. So we need to sort of pre-publish the key sometime before we actually start using it for signing. But in the end, this sort of looks like the heart of the problem. Almost. So if we look at this from a slightly different perspective, and we focus not so much on the actual replacement of one key for another, but we look at the states of a single key, it turns out that we actually have more things to think about here. At some point in time, the key has to be generated. That's clear. At some other point in time, the key will no longer be with us. In between, after much debate with many people and back and forth and restarting, etc., I think this is actually the true picture. I'm sure not everyone will agree, and I think this will be the basis of some fruitful discussion of the next few months, hopefully not the next few years, because I think this is, getting the basic terminology about key rollover things agreed upon is actually one of the major interests here, because that's really needed. But anyway, so this is our picture of the state that the key will go through. So the key is generated and it's sitting off somewhere. We publish it. That's when we put it in the zone file, so it's available, but it's not being used to generate any signatures. And when it has been published long enough for, old data to have expired from all the caches, then it's ready. And once the key is ready, it can be used to generate signatures. So this is something that basically happens automatically. This time is a function of, caching properties, etc. And this moving over into ready state will just happen. Then we have something that doesn't necessarily just happen, which is when we do this change over from one key to the next key and we begin using this key to generate signatures, that's when the key becomes active. So this phase is probably much longer than any of the other phases. But I couldn't do that proportionally on this slide. So this is perhaps measured in weeks, while this may be measured in, doesn't really matter, minutes or an hour or two. Once the key has been used for long enough, we want to retire the key. And that means keep it in the zone, but no longer generate any new signatures, but we have to have the key around because it's needed to verify signatures against. Once all those signatures have expired, again, this is something that happens automatically. Once all those signatures have expired, the key becomes dead. It's sitting around, but it's not moving anymore. And at that point, we can remove it when we want. So looking at this together with the other picture, we get something that is basically two of these state transition diagrams, one for the old key and one for the new key, where the move from having this key be the active one to the next key be active is obviously the rollover point in time. Not so bad, is it? Well, turns out it isn't so bad. It's just a question of keeping track of the details here. Because you need to move in this direction when you do the computation of various timestamps for things that happen automatically or happen as a function of, operator intervention. And then you need to move in this direction when you need to plan for the next big thing. So for instance, to be able to roll from this key to that key at this point in time, it turns out that you actually need to publish the key sometime in advance. And you need to be able to compute these times to actually have it available in the zone at the right time. But in the end, it's not rocket science. It's just a question of being careful. And this is the zone signing key. So what about this, the key signing key then? Well, the key signing key, I'm sorry, it's slightly more complicated. But if you look at it, it's actually the same general structure. Well, at least it's the same general structure in the sense that it starts being generated and it ends over there when it's dead and removed. And we have some additional complexity here in the middle because of the key signing key having an interaction need with the parent, because the key signing key needs to have a so-called DS record generated by the parent. So there will be various requests for DS or requests for removal of DS, etc. But in the end, it's the same general structure. So how to encode this in software then? Well, as it turns out, and this is also not in any way particular to what we're doing, it's really necessary to have a functional separation between, let's call it the policy part and the logic part. And then, of course, we need glue software to tie it all together. It may be that there will be hardware devices, too, for key storage, etc., although that's not necessarily always the case. Hardware is good, but it shouldn't be forced on everyone because it's right for some situations and it's not right for some other situations. The plan is that all of this, once we're ready, will be well publicly available to everyone, but we're not there yet. So if we look at the policy part, what is policy actually? Well, policy is a way of expressing what you want. As in, the zone owner has some sort of policy wish that he wants to express. It could be that I want to have the active life be this long. I want to have keys that I use for 4 weeks, and then I want magic to happen so that rollovers happens every 4 weeks. Or it could be that I have a DNS propagation delay, which is basically the time that it takes for changed DNS data to propagate from master to slave over to caches, etc., and be guaranteed to have replaced older versions of the same data. And that's a function of, well, certain zone parameters that the zone only chooses. There needs to be some sort of policy statement about what to do about emergency rollovers, etc. Do we have to have preparation for emergency rollovers? How many emergency keys do we need to have sort of already in the system and available in case of a problem, etc. So these are wishes. And then there's logic. So logic is sort of the safety net that catches things when the policy isn't enough. It's very important to realize that the point here is not to be done with a rollover at a particular point in time. The policy says, I want to roll the key by the first of each month or every fourth Wednesday or whatever. But the logic is there to say, no, you cannot roll right now because this particular next key hasn't been published long enough, or because we had an emergency rollover 4 days ago, and because of that, the next key isn't yet ready, and we have to hold on for a bit more. And in the end, well, policy is what you want, but logic is what you get, because DNSSEC, if you don't do it right, is really, really dangerous. Look at Gävle. So it is very, very important not to be overly enthusiastic about your policy knobs and this is what I want and this is what must happen, because if it's not safe, you don't really want to do it. So My hope here is that when we get all these various implementations, our work being one, and we have a bunch of commercial alternatives that are being turned out, and there are also other open source efforts. My hope is that we will be able to do some sort of fruitful comparison of the various systems. And for that comparison to be fruitful, I think it's very, very important that we try to nail down some agreed upon terminology, and we try to nail down the picture of how this actually ties together. What are the different states for keys? What are the different equations for computing the, well, forward-going time delays and backwards in time going preparation thingies, etc. And that work is underway, and part of what I've shown you will hopefully be submitted as an internet draft in a week or so, just to set this discussion going, to have it as an open discussion with everyone invited to nail down the language and the definitions of key rollovers. Because once we have that, I'm sure we will be much better prepared to actually compare the various implementations to each other. And that's basically it. As a user, I wouldn't worry too much about this right now, because 6 months ago or a year ago, well, there was a bunch of people, I was one of them, who went around saying, we need tools for this. But there wasn't so much actually happening. And now we can repeat the same thing, and we say, we need tools for this, and here's one. And, oh, by the way, we have five others in development here. So it's kind of clear that rather soon we will be in a vastly improved position as consumers of DNSSEC, because there will be all sorts of interesting tools available. It's just very, very important when you buy something or you get something from the net or whatever you do, that you're able to compare it against some sort of metric. And that's what I'm interested in here. I want to have this metric, this definition of terminology and this definition of the actual problem space to make it possible to compare the different alternatives. Thank you. Question. Questions now or later? No questions.
Well, my name is Joakim Wallen, and I work at, I am a security consultant at Certessa. I have been involved with various DNSSEC work at .se for some time. I'm going to talk about a bit about the open source tool. It might not be the most complex and fully featured tool that exists, but it is a starting ground. And as it is open source, it is even BSD licensed, it can be used and further developed to become something that you can really suit your needs. So, the obstacles that need to be addressed for smaller companies and home enthusiasts are that there need to exist tools that reduce the complexity and administration of a DNSSEC signed zone. And it would be preferred if it was cheap or even free. A while ago, I searched for available tools and came up with these three. ZKT from Holger Zuliger in Germany, DNSSEC tools from Sparta, and DISI from that Ripe develops. As you can see, it's not that many to choose from. I'm going to concentrate on ZKT as I find it to be the best overall tool. ZKT is a wrapper around the tools that comes with bind, and therefore you need to have bind installed on the machine where you're going to run the tool. ZKT also have mechanisms to automatically do some frequent tasks, such as reassigning a zone and role zone signing keys. It also have a semi-automatic way to roll key signing keys, but as that action needs communication with the parent, that action needs to be monitored. ZKT can set the revoke bit on a key, which is described in RFC 5011. What ZKT does is making the necessary work simpler. Creating and managing of keys is simple, as well as signing and resigning of zones. As you save all the parameters in that is required to meet your or your company's policy in a file. That file can be zone-specific, which means that you can have different key lengths and require resigning intervals depending on which zone it is. This is a typical linux.conf file, or in other words, the policy file. As you can see, there are a few parameters. Notice that you can even choose to have different random generators for key signing keys and zone signing keys. ZKT is a command line tool, and it consists of two parts, DNSX ZKT and DNSX signer. DNSX ZKT is used for key creation and key management. DNSX signer is for signing. But if DNSX signer realizes that a new key is needed for a signing to take place, it calls DNSX ZKT to make one. After the signing is done, either you have to move the newly signed zone file to where it's going to be used, or you have to do a RNDC reload. To load it into bind. So if you put a DNSX signer in a cron job, it will keep your zone signed and roll your zone signing keys according to your policy. Do remember that all keys are on disk with no further security around them. So design your system accordingly. If you need help with ZKT, you can get it either from Holger himself or from me and my colleagues at Certessa. Remember that Holger is doing this on his spare time, and so he might not have time. So always. Yeah. Links to two relevant places. First is, of course, the page where to download ZKT. And the second is an introductory page, which I was a part of to write. I was partly involved with when I at .se. And as you, the slides is downloadable after the presentation. You get the links. So that was my short presentation. Thanks for listening.
Yes, do you have any questions concerning ZKT? Okay, I have a question at least, since no one of you are asking any questions. I wonder, how much do you have to know about Linux and DNSSEC in general to be able to use this tool?
Very little. Yes. It's a very easy setup in Ubuntu, for example. You do have to change one small thing in a conf file before you compile it to match the Ubuntu system.
And there are setups or examples on the internet that you could find on how to use it?
The link at iis.se has some information about compilation, I think.
Okay.
I'm not really sure. But it's in the install file, and the install readme, it says.
You could find links. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. So thank you, Joachim, once again. And the next speaker, Mark.
Good afternoon. I think if you looked at your program for the session today, you would have seen another person's name next to this particular presentation. My colleague Joe Gersh, unfortunately, was not able to make it at the last minute, so I'm a last-minute substitution, but hopefully I'll be able to share some insights into the role of commercial products in helping companies deploy DNSSEC and be available to answer any questions you may have. We chose the title for this presentation for two reasons. First of all, I hope that within this audience we have people who are here because they're interested in the topic of DNSSEC and interested in finding a way of considering deploying DNSSEC within the domains that you're responsible for. But second of all, there's an awareness, I think, and certainly the previous speakers have all spoken about this, that deploying DNSSEC today is still not a trivial undertaking. And so there is a level of complexity that I think each of us has spoken about in our respective presentations. So certainly that is, I think there's an awareness that is a very real issue that needs to be overcome for DNSSEC to be deployed widely. What I'd like to do in this brief talk also is to suggest that there are, in addition to this issue of complexity, there may be some other things that you want to think about as you think about deploying DNSSEC within your organization. So certainly, we've all been talking about the issue of complexity, and you've seen a number of different tools, and in our case, a product that tackles this issue of complexity head on, making it easy, especially for people to deal with the complexity of the keys and the management of the keys, rollover of the keys that is required to deploy DNSSEC. But there are a few other things, I think, that need to be addressed for DNSSEC to really take off and be widely deployed, things that you should be thinking about possibly if you're thinking about deploying DNSSEC. So that besides complexity, the second consideration is security. The purpose of DNSSEC is to be able to enable your DNS servers to not only respond to a query with an answer, but to be able to guarantee that that answer came from the source that was authorized to give that answer, and it hasn't been modified somewhere in transit. So the response is only as secure as the keys, as the cryptography keys that are used to sign that response. So as you think about deploying DNSSEC, you must also think about what level of security is appropriate for the signing keys that we're using to guarantee the response. Another issue is the auditability of the system. So when you deploy DNSSEC and the management of the keys is so important, how do you know what the current status of your key sets are? If you're signing multiple domains, how do I know which keys are being used, which are in a rollover state, which are expired? I think Johan did a good job of explaining the life cycle of a key. So what's the status of all of the keys as it goes through its life cycle? And finally, this issue of scalability. Especially people with either very large domains or very large numbers of domains have to consider whether the system that you're considering deploying will be sufficiently scalable to be able to handle the demands of signing larger or very dynamic kinds of implementations. So I'd like to talk to each of these issues briefly. We've actually developed and launched a commercial product called Secure 64 DNS Signer that addresses these various issues that I've just been talking about. The need for simplicity, the need for a high level of security to make sure that you keep your signing keys safe, the ability to be able to audit at all times what's going on within your keys and the zones that are signed using those keys so that you can at any time you know where you stand with regard to the validity of the zones that are being signed. And this issue of scalability so that you can be sure that even if you start off, and we may have some registrars or service providers here who may have a large number of customers. Maybe there's some initial demand, but there's the possibility that there could be quite a bit more demand if DNSSEC grows into the future. So how do you think about deploying a system that can handle some modest demand to start with, but potentially having to grow into signing lots of zones on behalf of lots of customers? So this is what our particular product was designed to do and to solve these problems. So like most of the previous speakers who spoke about this issue of complexity, I think you see a common theme running through all of them, and that is that what you want to do is capture the signing policy in your configuration file, and then let the tool, or in this case the product, do all of the heavy lifting, all of the hard work to generate the keys, to roll the keys, to sign the zones, to re-sign the zones, everything that's required to deploy DNSSEC correctly. So you see a very similar approach here. Deploying DNSSEC in this particular product can be as easy as simply adding a line to the configuration file that says DNSSEC automate on. And that will, in fact, enable DNSSEC for all of the zones that are under control of this product. And it will apply best practice defaults to things like key sizes, key algorithms, rollover periods, signature validity periods, and so forth. You can also overwrite those defaults, so you don't have to take the defaults. You can overwrite them either on a global basis or on a zone-by-zone basis. So, again, if you're managing zones for different customers may have different requirements. You can set those parameters on a customer or zone-by-zone basis. So another question is, you know, what does this do to my current DNS architecture? How will the deployment of DNSSEC impact the way we set up DNS today? So in many organizations, the current DNS looks very much like a provisioning system on the far left-hand system side of the slide here. That could either be an IP address management system, could simply be a hidden master that you're using to house your DNS data, could be Microsoft Active Directory, could be a registry database if you are, in fact, a registry. And on the far right-hand side of the slide, we have the slave DNS servers that are responding to queries coming over the Internet. So deploying DNS Signer is actually as simple as sliding the box into the middle of this architecture so that we receive unsigned zones from the provisioning system, whereas those unsigned zones used to go directly to the slaves on the right-hand side. The unsigned zones now come into the signing engine. The policies contained within the signing engine. So we sign the zones, and we send the signed updates out to the slaves, either via ACFR or incremental zone transfer. And we're using the existing network infrastructure to log events, and warnings, errors, and things that might happen at runtime, hopefully no errors, to the existing network monitoring systems that you already have in place, whether that's syslog or SNMP or even email. The scalability issue is actually something that we came to appreciate as we were working with some of our beta customers, and we had access to a wide variety of different types of data sets, ranging from, on the left-hand side, very large ISPs or service providers who have and sometimes many hundreds of thousands of customers, so hundreds of thousands of zones, maybe each zone relatively small. And that represents one kind of challenge. On the far right-hand side of this sort of bell-shaped distribution curve, you have something like a top-level domain. Very few zones, potentially millions and millions of records, and we've been using data sets that are as large as 15 million records in some of our testing of our product. There are two kinds of challenges that represents from a scalability point of view. As you move to the left here and you have lots of small zones, the issues around key management, especially if you need the flexibility of configuring each customer possibly differently with a different signing policy, different key sizes, different rollover periods, and so forth, then you have a unique set of keys that you need to manage for each of those zones. So the key management challenges increase as you go to the left. And as you move towards the right, when you have to sign very, very huge zones, then performance and the signing performance becomes a potential bottleneck, and you have to worry about the performance of the signing solution itself. So we've actually designed the Signer product to address the whole spectrum of configurations that we might run into. What we found is to handle the many, many zones, we actually had to generate keys and put them in a key pool so that they are ready and waiting, because it turns out that when you need to sign many, many zones, a big part of the bottleneck is actually in the generating the keys to be used for each of those zones. So you want to pre-generate those things, have them ready and available when you need them, and then use them as you need to roll keys. And as you move to the right, we had to implement very high-speed signing algorithms in order to be able to get those zones signed, get those zone transfers out to the slaves while still meeting whatever your duty cycle is. And for many top-level domains, they need to push that the signed data out to those slaves very, very frequently, like less than every 1 minute in some cases. And that puts a lot of stress on the system. If you're somewhere in the middle, then this actually becomes a much more tractable problem. We've designed for the extremes, and so anybody who sort of fits in the middle, which is typical of, a large enterprise, maybe a smaller service provider, can easily be handled by this single product. Another thing to think about is, how do you ensure that your system will always be available? What happens in the event of some kind of a hardware failure? What happens if you were to lose power, lose a hard disk, something on your signing engine? It's not necessarily a disaster if that happens. These things, you need to re-sign periodically. You need to roll keys periodically. If you have a short period of downtime, that's not going to kill you. But you do need to think about, how are you going to recover from some kind of failure like that? And in the case of DNS Signer, we've actually designed it to be configurable to run in a sort of dual signing engine configuration, where you have an active signer and you have a sort of a standby signer that's constantly receiving updates whenever there's a change to the state of the system. It's actually sending the changes to the system to the standby signer. And should there be a hardware failure or some kind of failure that takes the primary signing server offline, you can quickly switch over to the backup. It has all the information it needs to pick up and continue the signing from there. And the key set that is constantly backed up is always backed up in a way in which the keys are encrypted, so that these keys never appear in the clear. Again, back to the need for security. So we're actually encrypting the key backup so that only another secure system can actually decrypt those keys and start using them should they need to pick up the signing operations. So a lot to cover in a short period of time, but I think we're in a transition period from where people wanting to deploy DNSSEC pretty much had to do everything all by themselves. They had to become experts. They had to do quite a bit of research. They had to do quite a bit of development work. They had to write programs and scripts. They might have had to integrate cryptography cards or hardware security modules into their solution to get the desired level of security. And I think what you're seeing here is that a lot of this is changing, and we're now seeing both open source tools as well as commercial products come into play that can make life a lot easier for people who want to deploy DNSSEC, want to do it much more easily, want to do it securely, and get into production quickly. So that's pretty much my presentation. If you have any questions, we certainly I think have time for a little bit right now, and I'll also be available. We have a booth out in the hallway. We'd be happy to answer questions you may have one-on-one if you'd like to do that as well.
I have one question. Is this product ready for shipment now? Can you order it?
You can order it. We are probably 2 weeks from shipment.
Okay.
But we're very far along in the cycle, so
it's almost ready for.
It's virtually ready for production.
Great. Any other questions for Mark? Yeah.
How do you handle the problem? I don't know if it's really a problem, but how do you handle with subdomains on external name servers and internal and external views?
I'm sorry. Could you repeat the question? How do we handle?
Is there a problem to handle subdomains on external DNS servers?
Oh, subdomains. Okay. subdomains on an external server. So if the domain's under your management control.
Yeah.
So we can sign whatever zones you have. So for the parent domain, any subdomains all the way down the tree, those zones are all under your management control. We'll sign all of the zones. In fact, if those subdomains are all under your control, we'll actually completely automate the chain of trust from the parent zone all the way through the children, so that within your zones of control, not only are you automatically signing, but you're automatically maintaining that chain of trust. So it's not a problem to sign as many levels as you need to.
Okay, and your product can handle internal and external views of DNS?
So you're talking about the bind, bind views? We actually do that a little bit differently than bind does. That's something we probably may want to, it's probably a longer question than I can answer right here, so maybe that's something we want to talk about right after the session. I'd be happy to discuss that with you.
Anyone else?
Well, let me try asking what I think might be a closely related question. Suppose you're running this at some middle or top level a registrar or a registry and so forth, and you have a subordinate zone that is signed, but it's not under control of the organization that's running your product. How are the keys communicated upward that have to be taken in there? Maybe that's a straightforward kind of process. It's just like any other record, perhaps.
Yeah, so we are supporting RFC 5011 in terms of automating the trust anchor from child to parent. So initially, if you have a parent domain that's not within your control and you need to get that trust anchor up there, that today is a one-time manual process to get that trust anchor, the DS record, up to the parent zone. But from then on, this process is automated, and the signing engine itself continually monitors the status of the parent zone so that it can tell when the key rollover is actually completed. So it sees the corresponding DS record up at the parent zone. So a one-time manual step to get that today, to get that DS record up at the parent. Beyond that, this process is automated.
Let's welcome our last speaker for this seminar, Patrick, who will tell us a little bit about OpenDNSSEC.
Okay, we're running a little bit short of time, so I will just tell a little bit short about the history of our DNSSEC work in the beginning. Up until 2005, we just worked a lot with the standards, and in September 2005, we started to sign our zone using our current tool. In 2006, we ran the signing of the zone for a full year, running into all kinds of problems regarding the management of keys and what Johan described with the expiring of the status case and things like that. We just removed the keys and then put into a new status key in production, so we changed all that, and now we have nice reloads with completely overlapping keys. In February last year, we started our commercial DNSSEC service, so now we believe we are ready for running DNSSEC in a way that it should be done. This is what our current system looks like. Our ordinary zone generating system is running just as it did before DNSSEC, but we have a new key management and signing system on the side. So when the zone file is being generated, it's being sent to the zone signer, and the zone signer signs the zone and sends it back to the zone file generator, which distributes the zone further on. For us to sign the stone today and generate new keys, it's a completely manual process. We have stored the case on smart cards, and we generate a new set SK each month. So each month we have to go into the server room and insert all this equipment into the key generator machine. And when the key bundle has been generated, the key bundle is moved on the USB stick to the stone signing machine. So only the set SK keys is being online on that machine. All key operations are manual today, which is hard work, and it's prone to errors, of course. We haven't done any serious errors yet, but it's easy to do things wrong when you edit the file, which has all the metadata about the keys. So you have to manually insert the start times and ending times on when keys are being used and used to sign the zone. So it's a it's a text file having all the policy about keys. Signing is done in software using IEC bind, so it's also very slow. We do incremental signing of the zone, so each signing is done in 5 minutes or so, but it's only a small part of the zone that's being signed each time. And our current solution is built for only one zone. As an organization, we have 100 zones we want to have signed. So for the smaller zones, we use ZKT today, which Joachim talked about. So what is OpenDNSSEC? It's a project to solve all the problems we have had from the beginning. And it is also a collaboration with Kirei, with Jakob Schlitter, John Dickinson, MNet Labs, and Nominet. We discovered that we have all of the same kind of problems. We all have the same goals with this project. This looks a little bit like the picture I showed before with the customer database, and this is the zone file generator stuff, and here's where the zone is sent out to. So what we want to build is all the stuff on the right-hand side. We have also, as Johan described, separated policy from actual signing and key management. So the policy is described in the KASP. It's based on work being done by Nominet, which is also very similar to what Johan has been doing with looking at what kind of things that are involved in key rollovers and stuff like that. So the policy describes everything. I'll go into that a little bit further on. The CASP enforcer enforces the policy and hands all the keys. It generates new keys and actually looks to that the policy is fulfilled. The metastore is where all metadata about the keys is being stored, just like our text file is today. The security model is a hardware security module where you can store keys, but we have also been looking into making a soft token-based PKCS11 module, which doesn't use any hardware at all, but you can use it for experimenting and just testing that the entire system works without the hardware. We have inbound and outbound adapters so that you can work with any protocol. Today we use SSH to transfer the zone in and out to the signing system, but you can use dynamic DNS updates or anything. You just have to write a new inbound and outbound adapter to accommodate your needs. We'll probably have databases about the content on the zones to do dynamic updates and stuff like that, because the signer engine has to have the complete data to sign. So if you just receive dynamic update within the inbound adapter, you have to keep score what the complete zone file is looking like. The signer engine has the responsibility. It's the driver of the whole system. It asks the CASP enforcer about, give me all these keys for this zone, or it can even handle the situation where there is no DNSSEC involved at all. It just outputs the unsigned zone to the outbound adapter. The signer engine uses separate modules for NSSEC or NSSEC3s, and the RSS signer just signs every record it gets. So that's the overview architecture. The use of HSMs is what we use today, but we have a smart card, so we want to get one signature per second performance out of it, but we want to use other types of HSMs as well, because we want to have a continuously secure storage of keys. We also want to speed up our signing a little bit. So we have mostly been working with some crypto accelerator cards, which are fairly cheap to buy. The CASP stores information about when and what and how for how long signing is, each signing signature is valid for, and if and why to use RC5011. It also has a lot of information about to use NSSEC or NSSEC3, and if you use NSSEC3, you want to also have parameters on that, such as resorting intervals and stuff like that. There's, of course, also information about the length and size of keys and where are we storing the key. If we want to change from our current system to the new system, we want to use two HSMs in parallel. So you need to have a way to say that this key is being used on that smart card in that device, or in that HSM over there in that slot. So we want to describe the CASP in sort of XML file. I don't think we're going to work on to make this a standard, but that's what we're going to use. And there will be some sort of API and for reading and writing that policy, because you can use that policy also for monitoring. So you can look at the zone and look at the policy and see if the zone is following the policy. So it's very easy to use that to write a monitoring tool. The metastore stores everything about the key that the CASP enforcer need to know that is not stored in the HSM itself. I already told you about that. The CASP enforcer is doing everything it can to fulfill the policy. So if you remove a key or revoke a key, what it does is that it's removing keys and creating new keys as needed. So if it fails to fulfill the policy for some reason, the HSM does not handle those kind of keys or anything like that. It should just warn the operator in some way that it can't fulfill the policy anymore. The signer engine is the core of the system. If it fails to sign, it should also warn, of course. It probably should cache the information it gets from the CASP enforcers in some way. As I said, the signer engine is logically separated. It has a module for just doing the signing, and it has has a separate module for doing the NSSECs and a separate module for signing the RSS. The NSSEC fire is making sure that the NSSEC chains or NSSEC3 chains is complete, so you never break the NSSEC chains. And the RSS signer, of course, talks also to the HSM or key store to fetch the private parts of the keys. And the inbound and outbound adapters will accommodate all kinds of input and output. So you can have your own single database if you want to. We are doing all development as open as we can, so we have all requirements information on a wiki, and also all source code is stored there as well. So everybody's free to look at it and tell us if you would like to change something or would like to cooperate with us. Thank you. Any questions?
Any questions for Patrick?
Policy module, the KASP. So I was imagining two things that if I were interacting with it, I might want, and I don't know whether you've included them or not. One is a consistency check so that if I put in parameters that are inappropriate, for example, a simple one is if the time to re-sign is longer than the lifetime of the key, that would be bad because then there'd be a gap. Do you have those checks in there? And so that's one part of it. And then the other half, I can see from your response that what I'm going to ask for next is even beyond that. When there's a whole bunch of parameters in there and lots of keys, I could imagine wanting some sort of measurement as to, for example, you have a pool of keys for the future and so forth. Is almost like a gas tank. Is it running close to empty, or is it in a good state so that if something goes wrong, there's time to recover from that? Some sort of measurement process that tells me whether I'm in a sort of maximally good state or almost in trouble or things like that.
I don't think we really look into creating keys for future use right now, but that might be a good thing to have. But I think the hard part, if you change the policy that are inconsistent with the policy that was just before, how to make the transition to the new policy, I think that can be hard.
Let me press on this just to give one idea. It takes a certain amount of time to sign a zone, and as the zone gets bigger, it takes more and more time. At some point, if the intervals are set wrong, the zone could get too big to sign fast enough to keep up. So
I expect that we're going to use incremental signing here.
That's fine. But what I'm thinking is from a management point of view, if I were a system administrator kind of guy, I'd be watching this process and I'd say, it's time to change something, either get a faster or shift to incremental or whatever. So how much headroom, how much...
I think that it might be good to have a parameter that says that signing shouldn't take more than this amount of time.
And then some sort of flag that's raised if it exceeds that or something.
Because I know that Nomnet has experimented with running several HSMs in parallel to improve that process.
Hi, my name is Magnus Sandberg from the user group Snooze. I get the feeling that this is not the production state yet. It's like a beta or development project for the moment.
We are planning to have the first prototype in March and maybe I'll have something that .se can run maybe in the next summer.
Thank you very much. And so with that, I would say that we have a quite good overview of the subject of DNSSEC, don't you think? I hope you have all learned something, and I would like to thank all our presenters with a big hand.